Thousand Eyes is the sponsor for this Day 2 Cloud podcast. Check out their latest internet performance report, COVID-19 edition. You can find it at thousandeyes.com/research/internet-performance.
Our sponsor today is VMware. And did you know VMworld begins September 29th, 2020, and it's free? You should attend because it's interesting, it's informative, and let's face it, you're not going anywhere anyhow.
Yeah, so since you're not going anywhere, register now via bit.ly/D2C VMworld. That's bit.ly/D2C VMworld. Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. Hey, Windows Shop folks, we got a show for you about automation, and we're going to talk about Ansible. Maybe you didn't know that was a thing. It is. Ansible for Windows is a thing, and even involving PowerShell, as it turns out. That's a thing. We're going to talk about the Chocolatey Package Manager a little bit, and it's all with Josh Duffney is our very special guest today. He's writing a book, Become Ansible, and we're going to just tap into his Ansible expertise, particularly in the context of Windows, which, Ned, I think it made you all smiles, didn't it?
It really did. It brought me back to my roots. And it was just fantastic to hear how Josh's progression happened and how it really closely mirrored my own. And I was unaware of how well Ansible could work with Windows. And I think that's actually going to be a shock to a lot of people because there's a very tight coupling between Ansible and Linux. And that coupling, while true, doesn't rule out Windows also working really well. So that was really interesting to me, is how well it could work.
Lots of interesting stuff in here and lots of details. Josh will take you places that maybe you didn't know you could go. So please enjoy the show. Josh Duffney, welcome to Day 2 Cloud. And hey, man, you've never been on the show before, so you got to introduce yourself to the nice people. Who are you and what do you do?
Sure. Yeah. First of all, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. My name is Josh Duffney. I'm a site reliability engineer at Stack Overflow.
At Stack Overflow, and a whole bunch of people just doot, doot, doot. Stack Overflow. Oh, that's the place I go to the internet all the time to solve my problems. So now we can put you on speed dial. So when Stack Overflow is broken, it's your fault. Yeah.
A few of my coworkers, our previous coworkers and friends, have already done that. So I suppose.
So I have to ask, when Stack Overflow breaks, where do you post?
Oh. Internally.
Exactly. Well, Josh, you're here on Day 2 Cloud today because you are writing an Ansible book. But I gotta just start with, like, why are you writing an Ansible book? Because there are Ansible books that are out there and there's docs and so on. So what is special about your Ansible book?
What's different about mine is it's written to be a beginner's guide. When I first started learning Ansible, a lot of it was like, here's everything Ansible can do. And there was a gap in how do you implement Ansible? And I actually came from a very unique background. I don't have a Linux background. I actually have a Windows background. And so there was a lot of assumptions that are made inside the documentation that weren't obviously clear to me because I don't have 10 years of background in Linux administration. And so I try to cover that in my book, where I don't focus solely on Windows. It's a mix. You will learn to develop playbooks against Windows and Linux and AWS and Azure. So I really didn't want to pick sides in the cloud or OS battle when I wrote the book, but it's really meant to take you from zero to competent. A lot of other books aim for mastery, to describe mastery. I wanted to lower the bar a little bit for my first book, and it's really competence, because what I found in IT is it's difficult to commit to something if mastery is what your aim is. I didn't know if I wanted to, you know, write a book on Ansible entirely. And maybe you don't know if you want to learn Ansible for the next 5 years or use it. And so the book is really a way to become, it's the best way to become competent in it to determine if you want to go and pursue mastery.
Mastery is exhausting. I've done a bunch of instruction yes. over the years, and what you need day to day is 20 to 50% of the product, maybe. And then a lot of the rest is corner cases, special use cases, funny little switches that were created for the thing. And the older the product is, the more esoteric the little things are that it does. And do you really need to know all that stuff? Eh. And yeah, it can be super off-putting if you're like, here's everything Ansible, boom, and it's this 3,000-page monster. You're like, I'm never going to learn all of that. So you don't even want to start because it just looks like it's too overwhelming.
Exactly. And the other thing is a lot of the documentation, they miss the implementation details. Like, how do I actually use this? And when you adopt Ansible and you adopt it for configuration management, The other thing that you'll realize is that you're not just learning Ansible, you're learning like five other tools. You're learning about source control, you're learning how to use Git flows, you're learning how to use a CI/CD system if you want to deploy it that way. So I try to cover those in practical examples throughout the book to show you not only how to learn Ansible, but how to use it and implement it.
Wow. You and I, Windows background, we've got a little kismet going here. I spent, the first 10 years of my career not touching Linux at all. And when I discovered things like Ansible or other Linux-friendly tools, all the documentation assumes you're running from a bash command and that you have access to all of those features. It's gotten a little easier with Windows now that there's like Windows subsystem for Linux and everything, but they just assume you have this corpus of knowledge because why else would you be using this Linux-y tool? And it's like, but I don't. And I just think it's awesome that you have created a book that is for the person that I was and kind of still am, if we're being completely honest. I'm curious, why Ansible? What drove you towards that solution versus all the myriad other configuration management softwares?
Overall, I think it's just simplicity and realizing after spending 8 to 9 months writing my own with desired state configuration that it wasn't worth my time to write it myself and I need to learn something else. And Ansible was really the lowest bar where I didn't need to build this like enormous infrastructure. It's agentless. It's really simple. You can install it with a couple of commands and run it. And that was really the pull for me in the beginning when I started to go down the path of Ansible.
Yeah, that makes sense. When I started my little journey towards automation, I think I started trying to use Chef first. And then I was like, oh, but I have to set up a Chef server. And sometimes I use Knife and there's these recipes. And it just got really complicated really quickly. And I'm sure it's powerful. I'm sure it's awesome. Same thing with Puppet. Like you have to stand up a Puppet server and install the Puppet agent. And there's just there's a lot of weight there. When I tried using Ansible, I was like, no, you create a playbook and you push it. And that's it. You're done. I was like, what?
Exactly. Well, that's the closest comparison to PowerShell. So my background, it's hugely PowerShell. I started Windows and then I found automation, fell in love with PowerShell. And that's really where my career started is when I discovered PowerShell. But I wanted something as close to that. And Ansible was that, where you can write a playbook and you can target hosts and it uses PowerShell remoting under the hood to talk to Windows. And so it was the closest thing to what I knew to help bridge. I use it as, describe it as the dark portal, as a Warcraft reference, where you kind of go into the orc side if humans were Windows and orc would be the Linux. Debatable who's which, but that's just how I saw it.
I was a Windows guy back in the day. I was an MCSE once upon a time, but 8-10 years ago, I kind of fell off the Windows wagon. Windows 7 was the last OS I ran in anger on my desktop, just to give you a sense of, kind of where I left off. So, all right, I moved into the Mac world. I've been Linux for 20-something years. I used it as a server primarily. What is the challenge bringing automation to a Microsoft Windows shop? I mean, I kind of remember, but I know things have changed in advance. So, in a modern Windows shop, how tough is it to bring automation there?
So automation is actually the easy part. Don Jones and the crew, Jeff Hicks and others, Richard Sidaway, did a fantastic job over the last decade of bringing awareness to PowerShell and automation. The difficult part is bringing configuration management into a Windows shop that runs on Linux. And it's because of the reasons that I mentioned before, where you not only have to learn Ansible runs on Linux, you got to learn just a little bit of Linux, then you've got to learn source control. And then if you want to be able to distribute it and run it in some kind of pipeline, you have to learn about continuous integration. And then if you want to deploy it in an automated manual and get out of the clicking business, you have to learn a deployment tool. And often those are each individual technologies. And so it's really the encompassing of all of that stack is the biggest hurdle for the Windows shops because that mindset isn't there yet. There's a mentality, and I used to be an SCCM admin, System Center Configuration Manager. So all that stuff that I just mentioned was sold to me in a product that I ran and managed through a GUI. And so taking out of those layers and getting away from, I'm just going to buy this tool, I have to learn many tools and become more of a craftsman in my career, that is the hurdle that I've seen and personally struggled through for having a traditional background in Windows administration and what I see other system administrators with that same background struggle with.
Well, I'll pitch this question to both of you guys since you're heavier in the Microsoft world than me. I mean, what is the attraction to this multiplicity of tools? Is it because they're open source and so they're quote unquote free? Or is it that vendors have kind of left a gap in the market where one tool to rule them all, there just aren't good choices out there?
I think you can't have one tool that will rule them all. That's the fallacy that we've discovered over the last decade is, depending on the situation, you need to have multiple. And with microservices, things just run better on different operating systems. And cloud especially has abstracted the operating system to a level that I don't need to be a deep Linux expert. I can write a really horrible bash script and get away with a lot. And so that abstraction of the technology is really what's fertile ground for a cross-functional, so to speak, system administrators that can do both. It's kind of the T shape, right? Where I have a deep expertise in Windows and PowerShell, but I can have a shallow, good understanding of Linux and other tools. And cloud and the abstraction of that is what has allowed me to do that, where I don't have to learn. Right now, I probably couldn't debug a lot of Linux problems in the operating system. But at least I know how to run commands and tail a log file, which is improvement from my a past version of myself a couple of years ago.
Yeah, wow. I feel this experience, Josh. right where you are. Just to comment on what Ethan asked, I also used System Center Configuration Manager, and even used when it was SMS back in the day. Mm. And the thing about that tool and tools like it is they're very, very heavy. They require an investment of time to deploy all the components, and they require a lot of care and feeding for those individual components. So while it is packaged as a single product, the amount of work to keep it maintained and patched and working is probably the same amount of work to figure out these other lighter tools that don't require nearly as much infrastructure to support them.
So there's kind of two fallacies you guys have debunked here. One is there is no such thing as we're an all Windows shop. Now it's a diversity of platforms you might be running a particular workload on, the right platform for the right app. You know, you're matching these things up. So therefore, you don't have a one tool to rule them all because you don't have one platform you're dealing with. You're dealing with multiple. That's one thing. And then the other is the one tool to rule them all doesn't mean it's all that much easier to administrate, we're saying. Because, I was SMS back in the day. You said that, and I went, wow, because I was like, whoa, we're going back in time here. Okay, yeah, that's a while ago. And you're right. Yeah, those were heavy. So let's talk about culture then, Josh. How does the culture of a Windows shop versus a Linux or cloud-native shop vary? And does that culture mean it's tougher to adopt Ansible or maybe automation or DevOps more broadly?
So in the Windows shop world, I think there's a mindset shift that's starting to happen, but isn't quite there. And it's because we've had the use of GUI tools. And so there's been this crutch that we've been able to use. But as you scale and as your company grows, like, you have to learn. That's where you see from Windows administrator to PowerShell scripter, that's a common path from you know, the automating system administrator versus the GUI tool driven system administrator. That I think the leg up that the Linux system administrators have is they've always been forced to use command line. And it's up to them then to figure out, like, how do I take these and evolve these tools and move closer to, quote unquote, a developer and treating my bash scripts in source control and you know, some kind of testing framework. The same is true for PowerShell. I just think that there's a natural gravitation and path more on the Linux side because they have that command line first mentality that's shifting on the Windows side. So I think that's the leg up that they have there potentially. Again, the gaps with PowerShell, the gap really isn't there. There's a fantastic language that you can use. And now PowerShell's across both, which has been another arm for me into the Linux community. But then for the cloud native one, I think the mindset is completely different because both operating systems are abstracted into PaaS services that you can easily consume. And so, yes, I need to run and maybe debug, but I don't have access in a cloud world to SSH onto some systems. I just destroy it and rebuild it. And so it kind of negates the need for me to learn a lot of the troubleshooting that I did before.
Because why troubleshoot it? Just rebuild it. Yeah.
Yep, rebuild it.
Yeah, it's funny what you're saying about the GUI versus command line mentality, because as a Linux person, yeah, I do think of CLI first, but I'm finding that as Linux tools become more mature, the number of command line switches and so on, it can get so convoluted to figure out what you actually need to do at a command line. You're not at the command line. You're actually building a stanza of multiple lines with different command line switches just to get something done, which can be maddening. And there seems to be some growth in GUI tools where you actually want the X console so you can fire up the GUI tool, which just takes care of a lot of the nonsense for you in certain cases. Sorry, I was just here last week, so this is very fresh in my mind as I was beating my head against a QEMU and a KVM trying to stand up some VMs and found the GUI tool for it. So maybe there's some crossover on both sides. Anyway, but I get your point. Yeah, your point really stands with the CLI versus GUI mentality.
What goes back to the abstraction, and that's where Ansible again shows benefit and other tools where I now have this language that I have learned with Ansible that allows me to do a lot of those similar things in an orchestrated manner on Windows or Linux. So maybe your series of steps was to create a file idempotently and then maybe start a service. That is two tasks in a playbook now instead of trying to figure out and do if logic. And so really it's about letting other people write code for you than it is about sticking in the command line and doing everything yourself or having to do that. So that's one way that Windows administrators that come from the GUI side can easily scale up, is because there are these tools that provide that abstraction for you. They come at a cost because you don't know exactly what they're doing, but they're there.
Right. Yeah.
Hey, everyone. We're just taking a short break for a message from our sponsor, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes, now a Cisco company, has a history of releasing cloud benchmark research. And last month, they put out the very first Internet Performance Report, COVID-19 Impact Edition, to look at how cloud and internet-centric networks held up in the first half of 2020. What they found was a 63% spike in outages in March, which coincides with the time when we all started to work from home more. Listeners can now get their hands on a free copy of the report. You'll find it at thousandeyes.com/research/internet-performance, and you can read about the impacts of changing internet usage due to COVID-19 and how those impacts varied across different regions and providers. For example, while 80% of all total outages occurred within ISP networks, less than 10% took place within public cloud networks. So the report looks at the performance and availability of public clouds, ISPs, CDNs, and DNS, and you get it across North America, EMEA, and the Asia-Pacific region. So if you're trying to plan or figure out what your cloud and IT infrastructure should look like now that we've all become so much more dependent on the internet, check out the report to help you benchmark some of those choices. Once again, it's at thousandeyes.com/research/internet-performance. That's thousandeyes.com/research/internet-performance. We thank ThousandEyes for being a longtime sponsor, and now we return you to your regularly scheduled program.
I do want to come back to that whole having to program your own idempotence thing at some point, but before we step off the culture train, I know that it's more than just Windows versus Linux. There's other people in the organization that have a say in automation and configuration management. So I'm curious how the internal culture impacts the adoption of something like Ansible, because when you look at it, like automation and config management is really cool when it works right and terrifying when it goes wrong, just because the blast radius can be so much bigger. So how does the internal culture sort of shift their mindset over to adopting this change?
So when I started to implement it, I found the truth that is Conway's law and how organizational design will influence how you basically build your systems. And so a good example of that is often within size teams that have siloed devs and operators, there is a central team that manages all infrastructure. And that's going to have a real impact on the way that your repositories are designed for Ansible or any other infrastructure as code. And it's going to have an impact on like how you structure your modules and break them up. Whereas if you had development teams empowered to do the infrastructure as code, you'd have more repos and it'd be closer to the app stack than it would be like a system or infrastructure as a whole. And so that was one of them. Another one would be it does impact everybody and there's increased risk. So if you have a cab board, like that's going to be a hurdle and you'll realize that you have to step outside. If you want to successfully implement this, you're going to have to step outside your role as an engineer and you're going to have to step in the shoes of an advocate and change agent and work on some leadership skills as I came to find to hopefully gain influence and communicate value that you're adding through this tool chain, because not everybody is going to understand what you understand.
Mm-hmm. Can't you just stomp your foot and get angry? I mean, that's a good way to communicate, right? Really show people what you want.
Hasn't been effective for me.
No, not worked out? Okay. Well, hey, Josh, let's dig into Ansible some more. So I think we've been talking about it as if everybody knows what Ansible is and everybody is an Ansible user, but that's probably not the case. So I'm sure everybody's heard of it, but let's take a step back. Give us a high-level overview of Ansible's components and how it works.
Sure. So there's kind of two ways that you can run Ansible. You can either run it from a command line, like an ad hoc command, like a CLI tool, or you can use it as a playbook. And so there's the power where it has that flexibility to both be a command line tool, but also a playbook. And so the transition that I try to walk through is command lines to repeatable to reusable. So you have your command line where you're doing idempotent tasks, you're running them. That's the leg up on traditional scripting languages, is like the modules that you use are inherently idempotent. So when I create a file, you don't have to add any if logic to test if it exists before you create it and avoid an error. It already knows that. But then once you run a few commands, it gets tedious, they're long, there's variables that are involved. You want to make it repeatable, and that's where a playbook comes into play. So the playbook would be a set of procedures or a sequential task list that would run in order that can then be linked together in any way to orchestrate the automation. So that makes it repeatable, where you can run that same playbook over and over and get a sequence of steps idempotently executed. Eventually, you'll get to the point where the playbook needs to be reused elsewhere. Another team needs to use part of the functionality. And if they copy yours and modify it, then you have two versions, and how do we keep them in sync? And that's where reusable comes into play with Ansible roles. So roles are the concept of kind of a individually isolated functionality unit, much like a function in PowerShell or a module in PowerShell, where that can be shared across teams and reused, and then you alter what it does by giving it parameters. And so there's the transition from command line to repeatable to reusable. And then from there, the sky's the limit, and you can combine them in any way that layer on top of each other to build out your infrastructure or configure your infrastructure.
So you build playbooks, and the playbooks over time, as you mature them through that process you just described, become effectively more and more capable for you to a point where you're reusing them and it's pretty much hands off. You're not really having to tweak them that much because you've built in everything that you would need to build into them to accomplish a specific task.
Exactly. And then once they're isolated individually and they're a component, then that component can be tested. So an example might be you write a playbook. First, you stand up a web server with a bunch of commands, and then you write a playbook to create multiple web servers. And then you find that you run all the time, you create a role. Now that role can be individually tested and used elsewhere, or open source or across your organization. And so that's how you make Ansible from making your life better to basically becoming a force multiplier for the organization.
So am I running Ansible like I install it on my desktop and run it? Do I have to have a server to run it?
It needs to be installed on a Linux operating system, but it can be anywhere. That was a real big hurdle when we first adopted Ansible, was inconsistent develop environments, where I'm running Ansible on a lower version. I can install it with WSL on my Windows machine or right on my Mac. The problem is the versions changed and our dependencies changed. The version of Python we were using changed. And so we actually pivoted to using Ansible inside of a container and then using volume mounts with Docker containers to be able to share our local IDE with it. And then that gave us the ability to have the same environment locally, but pivot between tags and different versions of the container if we wanted to develop and change the environment, but also to use that in production. So our CI/CD system used that same container, therefore giving a unified Ansible environment across the entire stack. And
with everybody sharing a common container, just checking that container out of the repo and running that, rather than having a single server with Ansible living on it and everybody logging into that server?
Right. The other way to use it is through Tower. So Tower is a paid version of Ansible that basically gives you a web UI and an API surface to hit. And that would run on virtual machines. It could run on containers, I suppose. But that is another alternative. The power that Ansible Tower has is delegation, where you can write playbooks and then provide a UI, abstracting away all the Ansible nonsense to a different team, perhaps, to let them run something that you've automated for them. It's a great way to reduce toil on your operations teams.
Another point that came up a little earlier about Ansible architecture is that Ansible is agentless, unlike, say, Puppet, which you have to have a remote agent installed that Puppet's going to talk to. Ansible is agentless. Now, in my times in the trenches as a Windows admin, agents were like, you had 20 of them that you installed on a box because reasons. There was all these agents. So is Ansible being agentless, is that kind of a big deal from a Windows perspective or not so much?
It's a big deal and a pain at times. And it's a pain because it means that you need to make sure that your WinRM is configured properly. Mm-hmm. But the same is true for PowerShell. If you don't have WinRM configured, you're not going to be able to use PowerShell. So it's a nice shared dependency between the two tools. I think the biggest hiccup there is getting Kerberos to work on Linux. But it's doable.
Okay. Two big and separate things there. The Windows one, I've experienced that as well, having to get WinRM properly enabled and listening on the firewall, but you don't want it listening for everything. So yeah, there's some tweaking there. I know newer versions of Windows Server and Windows 10 now have SSH enabled as well, or it's an option. Is that something that you've experimented with or looked at all for Windows machines?
I've experimented with it. The functionality was too beta to rely on for production connectivity, but it opens some doors. So I think with time, that's going to be the default, and it'll make it a lot easier to use something that can communicate with both operating systems over the same protocol. Will be a huge step forward.
You mentioned Kerberos on the Linux side. So is that because you're using AD as the authentication mechanism and not certs?
Right.
Interesting. What was the reasoning behind that, and what sort of hurdles did you have to jump to get that working?
The hurdle was mainly my lack of understanding of Linux, and luckily I had an individual on my team that knew a lot more than I did and helped me through it. That was the biggest hurdle. On the Windows side, the reason why was so we could use our AD credentials and we didn't have to have another service account or whatever when we're doing local development, and to basically have the same authentication method between PowerShell and Ansible was the main reason. Mm-hmm. And it increased security versus using like the pre-configured listeners.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Let's pause this fascinating podcast, Ned, because you and I have to talk about our sponsor, VMware. We're having the annual VMworld conference. Well, I say we like it's you and I. I mean, it's not us. It's VMware's doing the thing, and it's digital, and it's online, and it's free this year. And hey, we're both registered.
Yes, indeed. And there are some really interesting sessions that I plan to attend. I think the topics that I'm most interested in are everything that's happening with Tanzu, like that whole platform, whether it's mission control or what's been bundled into vSphere to get Kubernetes going. I've been looking through the session catalog, and there's just a ton of stuff for me to learn there. And hey, anything to do with VMware running on one of the public cloud providers also grabs my attention. What's pulling you in, Ethan?
Well, first of all, I'm laughing because you said Tanzu, and it's like he's a Kubernetes believer. He believes.
I do.
I guess I mostly do too. But well, of course, me, I went after all the networking stuff. So a lot of NSX stuff. So there's a session here about shifting to distributed systems architecture using NSX, and there's some performance related stuff, and there's a container networking deep dive, and all that kind of stuff is really cool to me. And of course, VMware Cloud on AWS networking deep dive is another session that I'm very keen on, because there's a lot of plumbing that's going on behind the scenes to make all of this interesting stuff happen.
Right. So if this sounds interesting and enticing to you, dear listener, we've got a registration link for you to hit up. It's special just to Day 2 Cloud, because that's how awesome we are. And you can find that registration link. It's bit.ly/D2C VMworld. That's bit.ly/D2C VMworld. And we thank VMware for being a sponsor of the Day 2 Cloud podcast. So the most common tutorial that I always see for Ansible or like any config manager is to install a web server for some reason, because that is the thing that everybody, it's like the hello world of config manager.
Yeah. Yes, it is. That's what I use, unfortunately. So I apologize.
No, it's fine. Like that's the go-to, and that's like totally cool, but you're using this thing in production, man. So you're doing cool stuff. What are some of the use cases or things that you are configuring on your Windows servers, and I guess just expand on that if you can.
It's the same. So it was a Windows IIS fleet, so I was using web servers. But beyond that, it was the layers. So we got to the point where we could deploy an entire new cluster. So we had the concept of a cluster, which is more or less a pool. So we have this new set of services that need to be deployed out. They don't have any infrastructure. If we deploy them against existing, it's going to overload them. We need new servers. And the pandemic was an excellent opportunity to exercise the work that we've done for the past 2 years. And so within a 24-hour period, we had a new cluster of servers deployed to each of our many, many environments within a day and configured. And so the way that that works is that the playbooks are set up in a way that they sequentially layer the configurations on the server, starting with security agents and baseline configuration, setting them up with secure HTTPS instead of defaulting to HTTP, installing stuff like Chocolaty to manage and automate software installs, and then moving on to the actual configuration of the web server. And I think 300 or 400 lines of Ansible that configures that with certs and all the bindings and all the output settings that need to happen. And then from there it goes and configures, you know, like the rest of the stack, like the load balancer, and the storage beneath it and the drives. And so it was like the full configuration of that cluster of servers is now codified, and we would just select a new environment and run, and then poof, we would have that cluster promoted through the different environments. And then able to, the biggest thing was, is it also added the agent that we used to deploy the code. So with one more API call, we not only could stand up the infrastructure, we could also deploy the bits to it. And then it was just a matter of fact of bringing the pool online and accepting web traffic.
Wow. So is Ansible actually provisioning the virtual machines in addition to configuring them? Or is that some other process that's then feeding in Ansible the information? Here's the machines ready to go. Go ahead and remote into them.
Because we weren't ready to accept another tool into the fleet of tools that we were onboarding, Ansible was chosen to provision and deploy, or deploy and provision. So it did create the virtual machine resources, it provisioned them and configured them. Having since experienced that, there is a lot of value in something else handling the deploy and provision to connect Ansible, something like Terraform. I know there's usually this battle of like Terraform versus Ansible, and every time that I would mention the two together, the Terraform mob would come after me and say that we're better at provisioning. I don't disagree. It's just a matter of how much time and tools you have. But I can definitely see where Terraform would be a really great solution to deploy, provision, and then as soon as WinRM is online through that Ansible could pick up and configure for Windows Stack.
Ned, are you in the Terraform mob?
Maybe. I haven't gotten my formal invitation. I'm waiting for, I guess, the pitchfork and torch to arrive in the mail. Of course, it'll be done declaratively. But yeah, I'm just waiting on that.
Are you a made man, Ned? That's what we're asking here. That's what we're really asking. So those of you that don't know, Ned's been involved in Terraform at a deep level for quite a while. In fact, part of their certification program was due to your involvement. So yeah, you're in the Terraform mob. Come on, just admit it.
Well, now I know who to ask questions because I got the Terraform Up and Running book coming in the mail tomorrow. So.
Yeah, feel free. Ping me and I will answer if I can. But I don't know. You're an Ansible person. Might be off the table now. It'd be a shame if something happened to your
Seems like some
Ansible
gatekeeping
repos.
Here. I don't know.
So I think you mentioned earlier that Ansible is actually, or it can use the local configuration manager on Windows, which was part of like PowerShell DSC, something that it was deeply entrenched for a while, and it was difficult to use. Well, DSC was difficult to use. So I'm wondering, is that how it works? And is this an improvement on the original PowerShell DSC LCM sort of family?
So the way I agree with DSC, I was definitely involved with that in the beginning and did the same thing. And that's where I created my own using DSC. I abstracted it to JSON and used Octopus to deploy it. So I've been down that road too. And so the gap that DSC has is that, and Jeffrey Snover said this, it's a platform, it's not a tool. And so there's all this tool chain that is missing. Like, how do you manage configuration? How do you share it across servers? How do you deploy it? That's not all answered by DSC. You have to create that. And Ansible picks that up. So it doesn't use the LCM. It uses invoke DSC resource and PowerShell and v5.1, just the same way that Chef and Puppet do. And that is basically a PowerShell commandlet that accepts a hash table of values that individually invoke the resource of a module, of a DSC resource module. And so when you When that runs, it'll independently invoke the test in the set of the DSC configuration. But then you have just this, there's a module in Ansible called WinDSC that allows you to use individual resources from DSC resources and then add them into your configuration. And I definitely utilize that for many things that I did, for whatever reason, I didn't want to port it over or if it didn't work. Like there are DSC resources that work better than Ansible modules. And in those cases, you want to use the DSC resources. And you totally can using the WinDSC resource in Ansible or module in Ansible. Mixing my terminology.
A lot of terms being thrown around. You mentioned something really important in configuration management land, which is test, get, and set, which I learned when I was delving into writing my own DSC resources, which, like, don't do that if you can possibly avoid it. But can you explain kind of what those three things are?
Sure. So when DSC runs or any other idempotent configuration, they have several functions. So let's use the example of creating a directory. So if you create a directory, it's a command line. It'll work the first time. Great. Try to create it again and it'll fail because it exists. And so that's where the test comes into play. So if you wanted to add some error handling to your create directory function, you would do a test path in PowerShell or some kind of if statement, maybe in Bash. Again, my Bash is weak. To do some error handling. And so that's what the resources, those methods of the resource do, is they allow you to say, hey, we're about to set this. Let's test the condition and determine if we need to execute set. So in DSC land and configuration management land, you would run your test first. Does this folder exist? If it does it have the right properties? Does it have the right name? And if that test fails for whatever reason, it'll invoke the set. But if it passes true and the test goes fine, then it'll leave it alone and you won't invoke it. And that is how you handle configuration drift in your environment. And also because configuration management is idempotent, you can run it over and over again and make sure that you're correcting the drift. But also know, hopefully, if you've written your resources right, that you're not going to destroy something when you run it again, unlike a PowerShell script with no error handling.
And I think we've thrown around the word idempotent and idempotency about a half a dozen times without defining it, but it's come up an awful lot here. But that's the idea of that we're trying to get to a known state. We're not just blindly changing things. We're looking at the state of something and making that state reflect whatever the playbook is saying it needs to reflect. So sometimes there's changes involved. Sometimes there's not. Sometimes we're removing something. Sometimes we're adding something, but we're going to get to that known state. That's what we're getting at there with that term, right?
Absolutely. And then I forgot to mention the get. So the get is usually used for compliance, where you would invoke the get to retrieve information. What is the current state? I'm not testing it. I'm not setting it. I want to retrieve and validate. And then that comes into play when you want to make people feel comfortable. It's a great tool to pull information and be like, it's doing exactly what we said it was going to do. It changed what we wanted it to. Here's the current settings. And it gives you a method to call that without having to write your own. Again, this is why configuration management tools add so much value, is they prevent you from writing a lot of code.
Mm-hmm. That would be, it's funny. I work in Python, and to set something to that state and make sure it doesn't have anything additional, it is exactly that. It's a lot of code to make that happen. It's kind of a pain in the butt. I want to shift gears on you, Josh, a little bit and talk about package management. So having been out of the Windows game for a while myself, as I was doing research for the show, I ran into Chocolaty, which I was ignorant of. Maybe everybody in Windows knows about the Chocolaty package manager, and I'm the only one that doesn't know. But I'm just curious, since Ansible works with Chocolaty, have you spent time with that? Is that a feature, an integration that you feel is worthwhile and interesting?
It is necessary. In my opinion, for anyone that is installing software. So I sent out a meme the other day that uses the Wonka meme, and it said, I don't often install software on Windows, but when I do, I use Chocolaty. And the reason is being an SCCM administrator, I wrote a lot of PowerShell that install software, and it's painstakingly boring, in my opinion. And so like Chocolaty does a great job of that, and it plugs straight into Ansible. They have a module, and it plugs into DSC as well. So if that's what you're looking at, but then it's installing stuff like .NET or, you know, whatever else you want, like you use it for your local desktop, a Bootstrap, where you can install VS Code or all these other software dependencies that you might have, it's completely automated and you don't have to write a PowerShell script or run msi/q to install it sneakily. I think it's necessary for Windows administration and automating software installs.
So then is the integration with Ansible a pretty wonderful thing?
It is, yeah. Because now I have a configuration that not only depicts my configuration, but also this like the software that's on there, which is technically part of configuration, but it's not like a little comment of like, I installed these three tools. And it's idempotent as well. The PowerShell is written in that way. So it'll test and make sure that it's installed properly in the right version. So if you want to upgrade, make sure you pin your versions, a little tip, so you don't run it again and grab latest and restart IIS, perhaps. That probably didn't happen. Probably did happen.
We've kicked around a whole bunch of things that you can do with Ansible for Windows. Now, if you go up to Red Hat's Ansible doc site, they've got a whole page of major use cases for Ansible for Windows. And I want to read those real quick and get your impression, Josh, if that sounds about right or if there's other things you do with it or if the Ansible folks are kind of kidding themselves with some of this stuff. So what they say in the docs, the use cases for Ansible for Windows, installing software via Chocolaty, which you've just said is a wonderful thing, installing updates, creating Windows users in groups locally or in a domain, seems pretty obvious, running commands or scripts, yeah. PowerShell stuff, I guess, makes sense. Then creating and running a scheduled task, which not the most exciting thing in the world, but okay. Is that about where you see it? Do you see it broader than that, more narrow than that?
I think I see it more broadly. Anything that you can. So here, I'll use an example. Been using Ansible for nearly 3 years, and I've not had to write my own PowerShell library or module for Ansible. That is how good the Windows support is. And I have 10 years of Windows experience, so I know what I can do on a Windows server. And I haven't had to write a custom resource. The one that I did was a report on IIS settings, and it wasn't actually setting it. So because it can hook into other things, I can run PowerShell in Ansible, just a shell script, a PowerShell script. I can run DSC resources. And then they have their own modules that are for Windows. And so that combination really left no room for me in my creativity to run and configure what I needed to on Windows. I think what they're missing, though, is that Ansible's value isn't in the independent tasks that it can run. Its value is in the orchestration of those tasks. That's the missing component that a lot of organizations have, even Linux and Windows. You can write anything you want in Bash, Python, or PowerShell and do it, but how you orchestrate that and you deliver it in a cohesive system, that is the true value that I see in something like Ansible and other tools.
You just triggered me, not in a bad way, but when you say orchestration, that means something distinct from automation. So automation are like the tasks you're doing in an automated way, but orchestration is that workflow that brings all those automation tasks together to accomplish the larger goal. That does sound like exactly what you're talking about. You don't mean that Ansible is an orchestrator. I'm kind of reading into this here. It sounds like you're saying Ansible's not an orchestrator, but you can use it in an orchestration workflow?
It is an orchestrator of automation, in my opinion.
Right. So you are calling it an orchestrator then, because of the way you can integrate different playbooks to accomplish a different task, and you can build the logic into those workflows and dependencies and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's even a feature inside Tower that is titled workflow that you can graphically, just like us, how is it, Scorch, I believe is the acronym, Orchestration Manager for Windows, another giant heavy tool chain that you can map out in a way, but simplistically you can do that in a playbook because it's sequentially executed and it has conditions. So you can create your own workflows and code and not necessarily abstract at the level of a GUI, but it definitely, that's what it does. That's its real benefit in my mind.
Right. I think, Ethan, what you might be getting at is like an orchestrator of orchestrators almost. The concept, like I would put that in something like a pipeline type tool where Ansible is going to be one portion of my pipeline that is, you know, I'm checking in code, that code is being validated through CI, and then I might have a stage where Ansible is doing something, and then I might have a following stage where the application itself is being deployed to the infrastructure that Ansible just created for me. And so I've orchestrated my entire environment build using this pipeline tool. But that's not to say that Ansible itself isn't orchestrating the build of the infrastructure that the application is going to run on.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm making subtle nuanced distinctions here. You know, Ned, earlier this morning we recorded a show with the basic idea of what do words mean, and it's all about context and where you're coming from and point of view and so on in IT for what a particular term means. And so If I look at Ansible from a networking perspective, I see it as an automation tool. I can push a config into a device in an automated way. Did I orchestrate the networking system? No. Ansible's not software-defined networking where I've got a controller that sees the big picture of the network and can configure all the devices with a policy in order to make that network do some certain thing that's meant to happen holistically across the entire network as a system. Automation is a tool that the orchestrating tool might use to bring about that policy and what it is that that network's supposed to do. Now, we're talking more servers and bringing a platform online to host applications. And so I think it does come down to what do words mean, you know, and in that context, it means something a bit different than it might mean for networking, let's say. And so, like I said, maybe I'm, you know, picking a distinction where there isn't really one necessarily, or it's how you use the words.
I think possibly Ansible Tower adds some of what you're talking in there because, and Josh, correct me if I'm wrong, because I only played with this product a little bit, but that does have the capability to monitor constantly environments and make adjustments based off of what's in your playbooks as that environment evolves. And to me, that feels more like an orchestrator than just a playbook that you run manually, you know, to provision environment, and then it stops running until the next time you want to provision that environment.
No, that's accurate. I think maybe to illustrate where my use of the word orchestration come from is as you evolve through your usage of Ansible, you'll eventually come to the place where you want to configure like a stack or a site. And so there's this term of a site.yaml, which is really the definition of your entire infrastructure stack. And so ours would look like, here's our web servers, here's our database servers, here's our Redis cache or something like that. And so that site would orchestrate the configuration of all of those. Now they have dependencies, like maybe Redis can't be online when the database is offline, or that orchestration in the site playbook handles that complexity. But then all of that is then obviously plugged into a higher level orchestrator of like a release pipeline where, okay, the site needs to be configured before we can deploy code, you know, and we need approval from CAB before then. And so there's these layers of orchestration, I suppose, is where, what layer of the orchestration model are we talking at, I think is where the disconnect is.
So each has their own tentacles and it's like squids all the way down.
Squids all awesome. Josh, do I really have to have Ansible Tower if I'm a Windows shop? Is that a strong recommendation, do you think?
No, you can also get away with AWX, which is their free version of Tower. I will say the benefit there, though, is the delegation. And so a lot of sysadmin teams, like we're firefighters a lot of the time, right? And we have this toil. And Ansible, through a self-service portal, it is a great way to reduce toil on your team. So an example would be, maybe you have this series of tests that you need to run every week and there's a Zoom call with another team and you're basically just clicking buttons that they tell you to do. You could write a playbook for that and then you could upload it to Tower, put it in Tower, and then delegate it to them through LDAP or whatever you might want to have, since we're talking about Windows Shop, probably have AD, and then they can run that for you. And then they'll just talk to you when it breaks or if something bad happens. But then you just have to be careful that you get the right permissions and make sure that the playbook does exactly what they want it to do. But then you don't have to be in that hour meeting. So that's the value that I see from Tower or AWX, is the delegation of automation that you've written. Because so often, this was something I ran into in my career about 4 years ago, where I just had all these scripts and I did all these awesome things. But eventually I just had all these scripts and buttons to run. That I had less and less time, even though I automated, there's always this like next level of constraint. So my next level of constraint was only I can do this. And so that's the real value, is the delegation, is getting other people to do what they want you to do, but you've automated it for them.
Only I can do this is one of the worst feelings to have. It used to be when I was like starting in IT, it's like, yeah, I want it to be only me. So I'm, you know, so needed. And then, you know, as you move on in your career, it's like, no, I can't wait to be not the only one. I'm tired of getting called all the time to fix the thing. I need to show other people how to use the tools and fix the thing. Oh, boy. So one thing we've managed to avoid somehow in this Day 2 Cloud episode, Josh, is the discussion of cloud. We haven't really hit it at all. So I got to hit you up with this question. We've been focusing on Windows shops and using Ansible. So is the intersection of Windows shops and cloud usually Azure? And if that's been your experience, is Ansible a natural fit where you're using it locally and you can extend the use of that tool into the Azure environment?
It's been my experience. So I had an interesting way to Azure. So I use Azure a lot now in my day job. I didn't so much. And I initially went to AWS. I don't know. I just did that to be different because all the other PowerShell people were going down the Azure route. And then I was like, I'm going to be different individual. I'm going to go learn AWS. And I did. I struggled in the beginning. It was really difficult. And the reason was the mental model that I had from a decade of Windows experience transferred so much better. And the people that designed Azure, because they're the same people. And so the integration with AD and the way that resource groups were mapped out, I just clicked better for me. But now that I understand Azure, I actually understand AWS better, which is interesting. Back to the question of, is it a natural transition from an on-prem Windows to Azure? And yes, Ansible still fits. There's less of a place of it for it in PaaS. So a platform as a service, as something like Terraform does a much better job of declaratively executing and deploying resources. But let's be real, the internet runs on virtual machines for the vast majority. You're going to have a much easier time moving your on-prem infrastructure to Azure or AWS as IaaS, as infrastructure as a service. And when you do that, there's still room for automation like Ansible in the mutable sense. So the way that I've kind of mapped this out is like Terraform and tools like that are really great for immutable infrastructure. So if you have a virtual scale set that just goes from an image and creates and you can destroy it and recreate it, there's no configuration needed, you don't need Ansible. But if you deploy a virtual machine and then you need to configure it and then a change comes and you need to update the software and you need to configure it again, that is precisely where Ansible should be fit into the equation. And it fits both on-prem and in the cloud, especially in the IaaS stack.
Perfect. Well, Josh, this has been an outstanding conversation, and we want you now to leave the audience with three takeaways. If they don't remember anything else about this conversation, give them three things that they can walk away with.
So the number one thing is that using Ansible in Windows is a thing. It can be done and very effectively. I did this post. So I did this experiment. I've been learning a little bit about email marketing. And so I created a landing page for my book that you can sign up. And I have a popular blog post about PowerShell that gets about 150 views a day. And I embedded it in there. And I was like, okay, maybe I'll get a couple people to sign up for the book. I thought it was really clever. 3,000 views later, not a single person signed up for a free chapter of the book. And then I drew this Venn diagram and I showed it on LinkedIn where it's, here's PowerShell. I'm doing circles with my fingers for people that are listening. And then here's Ansible. And then like this dot right in the middle where they barely overlap. It's people that use PowerShell and Ansible. And so like there's very little overlap. And hopefully this will bring awareness that there is a place for it and it works really well. I can list on one hand the people that I know that use Ansible and PowerShell. And then the second takeaway is get out of your OS camp, your operating system camp. Be comfortable learning both. Be excited about learning both. It's a fun world where the cloud allows the abstraction of that knowledge to be at a higher level. And it's fun. It's fun to learn new things. So embrace change, so to speak. And then with that, I would leave you with love to learn. Love the process of learning more than the outcome of learning. And you'll be happier than you've ever been in a career in technology.
Now, Josh, the name of your book, last I knew, because I actually bought a copy of your book, it's Become Ansible. Is that the title you're sticking with?
Yep, it is. Yeah, it's a play on words and syntax. So in Ansible, the way that you elevate your permissions is to use Become. And so the aim of the book is to elevate your understanding of Ansible, and that's hence the title.
And where can people get this book?
It is on Gumroad. So it's, I forget the full URL, but Gumroad, if you go to Gumroad, you search Become Ansible, it'll be right there.
Perfect. Okay. We'll have some links in the show notes at packetpushers.net or day2cloud.io. Just look for this show about bringing Ansible into a Windows shop or search for Josh Duffney. There'll be links in there. And Josh, you're still writing the book. You're getting close to the end. Is there an official date where you think you're going to be done version 1.0 or 0.1 as the case may be?
Yes, 1.0 will be released September 1st. And also, I forgot to mention, there is a landing page site where you can get the first chapter free. That's becomeansible.com. That also has a link to the paid book. So that would be the best place to go for that. But yeah, it should be released September 1st. It will be release September 1st. I'll hold myself accountable to that date.
It will be.
So become Ansible.com and you'll be able to get a free chapter there and so on. I've read some chapters and skimmed a lot of the chapters, and there's a lot of good content in this book, folks. Just telling you here, this is a good book, and it's not it's meant to be. It's readable and accessible, and you have context around what you're doing. And that's the big thing I love in tech books. There's some tech books that just seem to plow you over with details, and you have no idea really why you're doing what you're doing. And you don't have that problem with the way Josh writes, Josh. I like the way you wrote this book. So
that's a high compliment. Thank you.
If people want to follow you on the internet, Josh, how do they do that?
The best place is Twitter. It's at Josh Duffney, and Duffney is D-U-F-F-N-E-Y.
Lovely. Thank you again, Josh, for being here with us on Day 2 Cloud. And thanks to our audience for listening, and virtual high fives to you for tuning in, because you're an awesome person out there. If you have suggestions for future shows, we would love to hear them. There's someone you want us to interview, a topic you want us to cover. Ned and I are both on Twitter. I'm at EC Banks. Ned is at Ned1313. Ned's even got a form on his super fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. For other ways to keep up with what's going on the Packet Pushers Podcast Network, hey, we got a weekly newsletter, Human Infrastructure Magazine. It's loaded with the best stuff that we found on the internet and our own feature articles and commentary, because you care about our opinions, obviously, so you would want to read that, right? Yeah, sure. Anyway, the newsletter is free and it doesn't suck. You can get the next issue back at pushers.net/newsletter. We don't sell your email address or anything like that, because we're not awful people. Until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.